They know reason can't find God, because fallen reason can find nothing except the aspect of the fall. Only papists chase God on his terms, by his revelation, as we say, by Jesus Christ, can you find God, because then you find him. Faith has the knowledge of that which it takes. And faith is the evidence of the things it takes. If it's faith in the unseen, the evidence of the things unseen, as Hebrews 11 1 says. So when you take him by faith, you have him. Then you find him because he found you. Which you had all the time, yet he just hadn't found out, that's all. He found you from the beginning. Wherefore hidest thou thy face and holdest me thy enemy? This block had come in between of law and judgment and the mistaken concept of God. So God's face must be hidden because God is not law, law is grace. So if you see God as law, you see his face. And lots of people just go out and their moral services. They've never seen God because they've always seen law. They've been told nothing to do this, nothing to do. And that's not God. And they go out with a false concept of God, which is by some silly fussing up in the platforms and some songs or something, and they think that's God. That's not God. God's here, not there. You don't find God by hearing something about God. You find God by knowing the time and therefore being followed. Why do you hide your face? Why have you hidden your face? It cries out in 22. Which is a famous statement. Verse 3. Many have cried this, and God meets them. Oh, if I know where I might find him, that I might come even to his seat. That's the real half cry of everybody if they admit it. And the whole world, because the world, of course, is fallen in being, and therefore they're lost while they're far away from him. Oh, I know where I might find him, and I might come even to his seat. And in the same one, the search which comes this end can't find, it's faith find, it takes that. The search can't find. It may condition you to take faith, but it can't find. And so it goes on here, in verses 8 and 9 of that same chapter. Behold, I go forward, he's not there. And backward, I can't perceive him. And the left hand, there's going that work, I can't behold him. He hides himself on the right hand, I can't see him. Is that a statement? Apart this from God. Probably you all have to go through this in order to transcend it in faith. But what a statement. Behold, I go forward, not there. Go backward, can't perceive him. Left hand, there he works, can't find him, can't behold him. How did you suffer the right hand, I can't see him. Oh, that I might know where I might find him. 28. 12. Where shall wisdom be found? And where the place of understanding? He knows it's on beyond. It's a very beautiful, poetic statement, this one. This is a statement where he says, in verse 7, there's a path which no power knoweth. There's a very thin bit of that one. Which the righteous eye hath not seen. The highest who hath the clearest sight. There's a path which no power knoweth, verse 7. Which the righteous eye hath not seen. The liar's work is not sudden it. Nor the fierce lion passed by it. But where shall this wisdom be found? Where is the place of understanding? Man knoweth not the price thereof. There is a kind of land of Eve living. The depth says that in me. The sea says that in me. Can't be got the gold. Now the silver went to price thereof. Can't be guided by the gold of Ophir. No mention of the coral and pearls. Whence, verse 20, whence then cometh wisdom? There's the place of understanding. What a statement is this? What a statement. Can't be found here, can't be found there. Where is it? It's there all the time, but only by the freedom of the choice of faith, not by finding, but by accepting and recognizing. Now, and this is perhaps the last we say now, there will be one of the great leaps in Job. Job knew the truth. and flashing out like a beacon, because he knew it. There is no sign that these other men knew had this light. So I don't think they did. They may have had some faith relationship with God, but Job had a knowledge relationship, not a faith one. And sometimes you just burst out of him. There are three famous statements which you burst out of him. The first is in 23:10. Suddenly he says this. This is where he said confound him. Same chapter, he said confound him. I reversed that in a sense. Lovely. Verse 10. He knows the way that I take. When he has tried me, I shall come forth as gold. That's lovely. He knows the way. When he has tried me, I'll come forth as gold. That's faith. Then he took it one, two steps farther. One, a very big one. In 1315, he made the most famous statement in his book, which is a wonderful statement. It's still a gritted teeth statement. It's not a liberator statement. It's a wonderful statement. But it has an element of negative in it. So if a gritted teeth has that level, it's a gritted teeth. I hold on. So it isn't hold on, it's being held on to enjoy it. It's the other side, it's got you. And this is the famous statement. Though he slay me, yet will I trust him. If I can't even maintain my own ways before him. Even on that one. Though he slay me, yet will I trust him. That's what he says, comes out there. He find me, as I cry, as I come as gold. Though he slay me, I trust him. Now there's a negative there, as a kind of, well, I may be slain. Not that there might be some purpose of glory in the slay. But it's used by thousands, and blessedly used. Oh, tens, I say millions have stood their ground on this precious statement. But the whole book is worth the whole statement. Though he slay me, yet will I trust him. That's the human side of faith. The divine side of faith is the substance that comes to you. Now that substance came marvelously to you in a marvelous statement. It is man, perhaps the first book written in the Bible. And that is in chapter 23, verse 10. Am I right? No, sorry, I did you wrong one. It's 1923. No, yes. Nothing? No, I looked at it. I didn't remember. It is 1923. Burned out of it. All of my words are now written. He suddenly lifts right above all this stuff. All that they were put in the book, and they were graven with an iron pen, and laid in the rock forever. For I know that my Redeemer liveth. And then he goes on. He not only says he's here now, but he said, come up, come back. It's the first statement of the direct statement of the second coming of the Bible. He shall stand in the latter day on the earth. And there is the Father, and he says, I'm going to have a resurrection body. This is fantastic. This is the original translation. I think the tried Christians have been telling me our translation in verse 26. Though after my skin worms destroy this body, yet in my flesh shall I see God. Obviously the new flesh. Whom I shall see for myself, person to person, and my eyes shall behold, and not another. Isn't that wonderful? God's sake. After all this, a power of God, this man had life, of course. You need it then? For I know that my Redeemer liveth, and I know that he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth. And even though this body is corrupting, yet in my flesh shall I see him. And I shall see him some day, I shall see him face to face. See for myself and my eyes at the home. And then he said a lovely thing. He caught it. Lovely thing. terms as it were from others. But you should say, or what you should say is, why persecute ye him, seeing the root of the matter is found in me? Is that right? So why don't you say, what do you persecute that fellow for? The root of the matter is in him. You should say, here's the root of the matter. I have my God, I have my Redeemer. I am in this redeemed relationship. It's here and going to come to pass. And I trust this word of glory. This was word of glory, not word of gritted teeth, but word of realized faith. So right in the middle of this great cat shall not. Now that's the end of the interchange that took place between Job, his three friends, and talking with God. God, not just talking back to him. Talking with God, making questions to God, finding his way. And you see, he had the way, but because it wasn't confirmed in him yet, he slipped up. And he moved into a legal controversy which he wouldn't have moved into if he showed the way, because he really wouldn't see law. He showed the way, you know, what does the God, there's nothing wrong. They're not bad to you. The fact that he responded to law means he hasn't quite got it yet. And there's a certain element in which he saw things under the law level, which is the self level. I should be this, I should be that, and God punishes and all that. And so he had to be lifted into a permanent level where this law stuff had disappeared, and had lifted others up to him. So it was necessary to go through this controversy and attempts of justification, and then questioning about himself and trying to find God, and so on, with these flashes of lifters. We haven't finished this morning, I thought we might. Well, that's all I'll say. But, this evening we finish David. Not that that would take a great deal of time, there are a few things. We've done, in some ways, the major parts of David that are best to look into. That's all. So again, tomorrow, this evening may be fairly short, I don't know. Where are we going at? So, you're already going at it? Okay. Have the intervention of Elihu. Before the direct word came from God to Job. We know nothing about Elihu, except he's a young man, and had something very strongly on his heart to say to Job and his three friends, and they form a little bit of a preparation for what the final word is to be, direct from God. Eli's talk recorded is from chapter 32 through 37. He was a modest young fellow, because he said that he'd sat with them and had been quite stirred by the give and take between both on the part of both the friends and Job, but he'd waited to speak until the others had spoken, because they were older than he. He says that or it says that when they had no more to say, they did have no more to say after Job had given his final opening up in his past life, which is an enormous impressive, which we started with this morning, the kind of life he lived in his previous days. Apparently they shut their mouths. They felt, what more could they say in a man who lived a life like that? Anyhow, they didn't say anymore. Job seem to wish to add to it. So now Elihu stepped in. I like that. He wasn't pushful, he wasn't making sure he knew better than other people. But he did say he had a strong sense of urge to speak. He spoke of it in the 8th verse as a spirited man, and the inspiration of the Almighty gives understanding. He felt he had some further understanding to give. And it was burning in him to pass it on. And he made a little appropriate remark for his elders. Great men are not always wise, neither do the aged understand their judgment, which is a little wag for them. And so he, now quite modestly, asked him to listen to what he had to say, and I think it was acceptable to him because he had this modest approach. He spoke of himself as being full of matter. The Spirit was constraining him. That's good. The person should want to say something. That's in the 18th verse of the 32nd chapter. What he did say was really a rebuke, both to the friends and to Job. He spoke quite plainly to the friends and adequately. They said he was discerned about the three friends in the third verse of the second chapter, the 32nd chapter, because they have found no answer and yet are condemned guilt. That's very good. That about sizes it up. That's what stuff ourselves when pulling other people down. They find no answer, and yet they condemn them. They didn't replace what they said by an adequate, satisfactory alternative. And that's just what it was. Of course, thank God, we do move in with the alternative. That's why we feel we've got something to say. Emphasis in all our talk, of course, should be, if we do touch the negative, always that we're presenting the alternative, the replacement of the negative, by the positive. Concerning Job, he said straight out that he wanted to speak because he's righteous in his own eyes. As I say, I don't know that's wholly fair to what Job said. He kept saying that the real righteousness of Job was not to be attributed to Job in his self-righteous way. It was a product of his relationship to God through grace and the Spirit bearing fruit to him. I think it's fair to say that. I think all the things he said all the way through, the attitude he had, proves that, because that Satan couldn't touch. That is, he had a fixed inner consciousness that God was working his ways out. He was God's man, and all that came through was God's will. And he had got disturbed from that by these discussions. However, it appeared like that to Elihu, that he was righteous in his own eyes, and there was some truth in it. He repeated the much the same thing in the 33rd chapter, that Job had spoken in his hearing, he said, and that his words had been that what Job was supposed to say, I'm clean without transgression, I'm innocent, neither is there iniquity in me. I still think that's fairly true, referring to outward sins, but on the other hand, he did say he had a sin before God. And no man could say he was justified before God. Elihu seemed to pass that away, such that he felt the other was the major defense Yeah, it was raising, it was. Okay, righteous. And then he was complaining against God, so Elihu questioned him, saying, behold, Job saying, he finds occasion against me. He comes to me for an enemy, pushes my feet to stocks, marketh all my paths. He quoted that as being the general attitude of Job, questioning, even murmuring against God, as well as defending himself against the accusations of being a sinner by his friends. Now the one answer that Elihu did give, which I think in one sense is what he was right to say and the right thing. He just says this, behold, in this, verse 12, in this thou art not just, I answer thee that God is greater than man. That's about it. So I think Elihu did have a clear word there. God is greater than man. So if you're, what are you doing, raising questions if you knew better than God? He further took that further, and he said, God speaks to us in a way. He doesn't specify it more clearly. He said, God speaks once or twice by dreams. And he opens the ears of men to give instruction, so that he can withdraw men from their wrong ways, keep their souls in the pit, and chastens them. So there's a little bit of the truth. He is not saying what they said, that God condemns them to Job and casts Job out because he's a sinner, and Job has been punished for it. He didn't say that. He did say that God has ways in which he chastens us, and says things to us in a vision or by outer circumstances to keep us from going the wrong way. He chastens us also with pain upon a man is chastened also with pain upon his bed, in verse 19. And the multitudes of bones with strong pain, and so on. So he didn't antagonize Job in the way that the brothers had done so. Made a few little other statements about God, which are pertinent as a preparation, in verse 34, chapter 34, verse 16. He said, if now thou hast understanding, hear this. Hearken to the voice of my words, shall even he that hateth right govern? That's a pertinent remark. If you're a governor, you can't be governor on the basis of hating right and loving wrong. The idea of God, if God is God, he can't have built an earth in which he hates the right and furthers the wrong. That's chaos. In the sacred of God, he is the governor of the universe. He governs to make the best universe he can. Oh, that's sort of a common sense remark. Is it fit to say to a king, thou art wicked, and the prince is you're ungodly? But sometimes you do in this human world, but the idea is that the king is governing in the best way for his people. It doesn't always work out like that, as we know. So he made that remark. And again, verse 23 of that same chapter, for God will not lay upon man more than right, that he should enter into relationship with God. That what God lays upon man is right for that man. That's a good remark too. So he's gradually saying some things to Job which should counter his almost violent question or he'd been taken through, that God will not lay upon a man more than he's right for him to have, so he shouldn't be in a position which he can counter God about it and enter into judgment with God about it. And that we should take it that a true governor is governing in the way which are right for those for whom he governs. At least we should say that of God. So he then said, therefore it is meet to be said to God, I have borne chastisement, I will not offend any more. So he takes the chastisement line rather than the punishment line, which is really the truth. It isn't really chastisement. It is perfection. It's God's way of leading Yeah, that is the wrong attitude, the negative attitude, which carries out to the positive attitude. Call it chastity within your life, but I think there's part of the process of perfection. Perfection is union. Stabilized union. That which I see not, teach thou me. If I have iniquity, I will do no more. That's the major part of what Elihu says, and it adds that much to what the others have put a little correction on. The best thing of all is God is greater than man. That shuts you up. Shouldn't you think of God as God is the author of the universe, that he authors on the right lines, not wrong? He doesn't author it for chaos, but for harmony? Shouldn't you therefore take it that if he lays certain things upon man, he does it because that's exactly what suits the person in question. He also had picked this up, as you mentioned before, so I think it's true, he came to be what Job said he missed. He wanted someone between them, who would kind of put their hands on both their shoulders and explain things between them, him and God, a day's man, a mediator. And Elihu speaks as the one who understood that this is what he was there to do. Behold, I am according to thy wish in God's stead. That's in 33:6. Behold, I am in accordance to thy wish in God's stead. I also am called out of the prey. Another little phrase which has gone down to history, one of the phrases that is used at least in the English language. If there be a messenger within an interpreter, one among a thousand, to show the man's righteousness. It's a phrase we use of a special person, a special benefactor. That's 33:23. So that's come right into our common English phraseology, certain phrases that have come out of this book of Job. If there be a messenger with him, and an interpreter, one among a thousand, to show unto man his righteousness. Then he is gracious unto him, and saith, deliver him from going down to the pit, I find a ransom. Some touch of a mediator, some touch of an intercessor. He's one among a thousand, and he will step in, and he will call on God to deliver him from destruction, and that he's in a sense providing a ransom. Though all these things work of God, oftentimes with man, to bring wretched soul from the pit. That's the known lives that Elijah took with Job. He did speak strongly in the end, and again, perhaps he's right, in the 34th chapter, he again strikes at Job. He said, what man is like Job who drinketh up scorning like water? That's in verse 7. Then he says this, Job has spoken without knowledge. His words were without wisdom. My desire is that Job should be tried unto the end because of his answers to wicked men. For he had this rebellion unto his sin. So he wants Job to have all the trial he should have, which can fit him for deliverance. Well, that's true in a way. We respect each other. They don't take us all the way down in comparison to going all the way up. So again, we made a bold statement, and a statement which fits the facts. And his final word to Job, again, was good. In the last chapter of his talk, 37th chapter, and the 14th verse, hearken unto this, O Job, says of consider the wondrous works of God. And he does actually, through that chapter, begin to touch a bit on God's manifestation of himself in the wonders of nature. God puts it up in full force himself. And I should just give a little touch in that direction. So God is preparing Job for what God's going to say to him. So that's about the gist of what he says. God's greater than man. If God is the ruler of the universe, you should take it for God. He's ruling rightly, not wrongly. And what he gives to each of us, it suits our condition. You've spoken words out of turn, Job, which isn't, as I say, all the truth about Job, but certainly not the basic truth about Job. And it's good that you should have what you need. Have the sun sprinkled on you until you're ready to get a right adjustment. And his final word now, says Job, if you have a little idea of some of the greatness of God, hearken unto this, stand still and consider the wondrous works of God. That ends the records of what man's had to say in these fiery trials of Job. What Job said about him, what these three men have said about him, and some summing up, and challenge, and call to Job to look up to God now, listen to what God has to say, from this young man who sat in apparently with them all through the time. Now, there remains what God says. The basis of what God says is quite plain. Faith must always be a leap beyond reason, although it may have a certain amount of help it, which is accepting what it takes on its own values, on its own terms. Always is. Faith is always a leap beyond the the certain. A thing may be available, a thing may be suitable. You cannot put it reliable. A thing is only proved reliable when we attach ourselves to it, and then in the attachment we prove reliability. So faith is always a leap beyond reason. Reason to check it, a thing being available and suitable, but cannot take it to the certain level is reliable. When God now speaks to Job, he makes no attempt to reason with Job. He speaks to him as a whirlwind, apparently. So now you listen to this, Job. You listen to who I am. That's all. You listen to who I am, then answer. He says, you darken counsel by words without knowledge. Because he had the counsel he saw previously, at the beginning, he had it right. He darkened it by being caught up in the question of what he said, was God punishing, what was God meaning by it all, and so forth. He moved off from simple faith to inadequate questioning. The etiquette needs to be there. They might be replaced by etiquette reasons. You shouldn't have them now. All these sense of guilt is that. Listen to what I'm saying to you as a revelation of myself. And allow yourself that. Or I'm going to tell you who I am. You allow yourself up with that. These were the early days. Revelation hadn't yet come in the love of God expressed to us as it is in Christ. So there's no revelation of that type in this presentation of himself to Job. But it's opened Job's eyes to the kind of person God is, evidenced by what he does. Line yourself up with that. Can you do that? Can you do this? If you can't, what's your question to me? If there's this and this and this and this being done around you, being done perfectly, in the harmonies of creation, why are you questioning me? Why don't you take and glory for all ideas in the right harmony? That's the basis of this challenge. It comes out in a marvellous and often poetic declaration of God in his creation. There's great beauty in the statement, but has constant challenge. He's constantly bringing up situations in creation which are obviously beyond the presence of man when they were created, or the power of man in fulfilling them. And he keeps asking Job, can you do this? Could you do that? And he starts from the creation when he says, where wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare thou hast understanding. Start there, where were you? When I laid the foundations of the earth. Which is added, that little statement, which is also his great favorite, and gives a little touch of the joy there is in the creation and the goodness in the creation, which is going to come out in all his glory again one day when the earth is filled with knowledge of the Lord and the water covers the sea, and then the corruption of creation is removed. And that lovely phrase, when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. Are you there? That's a symbolic indication of the glory of the true universe of God to which it will be restored. As it says, this groaning earth is waiting for the manifestation of the sons of God that they may participate in the freedom of the redeemed family.
Please turn the tape over at this point.
Which puts in the prophecy of Jesus, look at the sea. Could you bind the sea so it has certain shores and limitations? There's verses 8 onwards. So it doesn't overflow and flood anything, so it keeps its place. Could you do that? And then he moves on to verse 12. He says, could you produce the wonderful dawn for the day spring? Beautiful phrase, the day spring of an eye, especially the cause of Jesus. But we all know the freshness of the dawn. Could you bring that to me? And when the light burns, he uses as the light shines and removes the high hidden point that people do things in secret that they shouldn't do. Could you do it the other way? Can you open the gates of death? Can you handle death in its meaning? Do you know the meanings? One great question mark that runs through history. What's death? Do we find the answer in Jesus Christ? That's in verse 17. Do you know where light comes from? That's the great question of scientists today. What's light? Everything's light. We find out its speed, how it's operating. Scientists say, I believe everything really is some form of light. Which world is the world of light dwelling? So he continually asks things which take man totally out of his depth. After Whatever it is now, 5,000 years, we're still out of our depths. We're still feeling it, investigating around through the telescope and through the electronic microscope and so on, trying to find from the tiniest particle up to those things they have up there, what they call, where the stars go together, what they all mean. They were rather good, because heading over the treasures of the snow, and he's got these different poetic terms. Have you seen the treasures of the hail? Can you produce this beautiful thing snow, a sparkle in the sun? That's in verse 22. It's the rain that brings freshness by that drought and famine. Can you do that? Can you cause it to rain, he says in verse 26? Cause the rain of the wilderness where no man is, and bring fruit into desolate ground? 27. I love the phrase, hath the rain a father? You've got these perfect phrases, it's a beautiful, for shooting in. 28. Hath the rain a father? What a simple, beautiful way of putting it. Are you the father of rain? Ice? Out of whose womb did the ice come? Did you produce that one? Out of whose womb, is that a phrase? Come with the ice. And the hoary frost of heaven, who has gendered it? And we all know the beauty of the frost when you get these, as we go down in Washington these days, when the ice freezes on the trees, every little branch sparkles. Did you do that? Then he turns it away from things of earth to things of heaven. He says, can you keep together that little group of stars for the Pleiades? There can be seen a little group in the heavens. Could you hold those together? Verse 31 is one of the first time that points, and the amateurs have written much about it, about the situation of the stars, the astronomy, the little group called the Pleiades. A sweet influence. I don't know why that phrase is particularly used, but again, a beautiful phrase. Canst thou bind the sweet influence of the Pleiades? Or could you loosen up that which holds Orion together? Orion is that great constellation, like a man with a belt. And even one of its stars alone, Betelgeuse, a great central star, is about 1,000 times as big as the sun. Just one star. This great band which goes on named Orion. Any of you, of course, during the tropics, it's a thrill to see the night sky in the tropics. With the southern cross shining. It's a peculiar light you get in these, and you can see the Orion there so often, and see these, there's just a few of the constellations you know of. Because we've left a lost star behind, you know, and a glowing, beautiful glowing southern cross you get. Night after night when I was going down the Nile, I went about five times down the Nile, on little pedal steam them on the crocodiles and whatnot, and it was a little mosquito treading at night. There you can see the beautiful tropical sky. Every star seems to have an extra shine about it. Can you do that? Can you handle the zodiac? The word in the King James is Nazaroth. Catch that being forth in measure, Mazaroth is a zodiac. There are great reports, of course, about it in astrology about the zodiac. It's supposed to be in the aquatic age today or something, aren't they? But also history has been something about the zodiac. It seems to have been some silent outline of the gospel message. I'm not going to that ever. There may be much about astrology, which we don't think much about. There may not be much in it. There is something in the wise ways of the East. Those men saw something of the star which died in the Bethlehem. I'm not entirely going those things at length, but some may. But I'm not saying there isn't something in the zodiac and the message of I think they're able, if anyone has done it, to trace out the process of the gospel through the different sides of the zodiac. Here he mentions it. Can you bring forth the zodiac? Bow that great lumbering constellation called the Bear, the Great Bear. Trust thy God Arcturus with his sons, that's the Great Bear. So again, he puts put him on the spot. Can you handle this man? Touches some animal nature. He starts by the line. He says, could you find a prey for the line? Verse 39. Could you think? You ever asked the young lion? Could you provide them with the necessary meat? Or could you show the way where to get the food for the young ones? So he thinks of the bird getting the food for the young ones. Lions won't get the food for themselves, finding a prey. And we all know in the bird life how they spend their ages getting their different food for their young ones. And so the verse 41, could you provide the raven with the food for which his young ones cry to the God? This is some of the sillier, wilder types of animal, less known to us now. The breeding of the wild goats. Could you undertake how they bring their children into birth? The wild goats? Can you remember the months they fulfill? In other words, the months of pregnancy? Can you order that, the regular pregnancy of animals? Or could you handle a wild ass, a wild donkey? It's a very independent gentleman, the donkeys usually are, human as well as animal. Could you handle him, this independent fellow? His house is in the wilderness, the barren land is barren. He scorns the multitude of the city. The guy is not the cry of the driver, takes the words of anybody. Lovely these touches, aren't they? The range of the mountains is his pasture, he searches for the green thing. Ox the same, called the unicorn here. The animals, of course, are more the desert animals. That's verse 9. The wild donkey, the wild ass, is verse 5. That's chapter 39. They have their little touches. He says, could you produce the goodly wings of the peacock? I like that one, don't you? 13. Could you produce those wonderful colorings? They just drew the goodly wings of the peacock. And he kept a very opposite end. Could you produce that funny, careless animal called the ostrich, who goes and lays his eggs in the sand, leaves the sand to warm up and forgets the eggs? And then he says, and it is God who deprived her of wisdom. I like that one. God made him silly anyhow, so that's his fault. I like that touch. That's in verse 17. But God deprived the ostrich. I didn't know ostrich didn't do that, actually. They didn't care about the young ones, hide the eggs in the sand, risk to be crushed, and let the sand back to the warm sands as the incubator. And God is deprived of wisdom. And now the ostrich is lifted up as if on high, scorned at the horse and his rider. Have you seen that? The ostrich is there, in front here, carrying for nobody. There are things like that beautiful, magnificent statement on the horse. It's worth reading that. All right, the way through. It's a poetic. The horse, well, we all feel the strength of the animal, that clean-cut animal. We've always loved horses. There's great limbs, there's wonderful muscles. It's been special, like something sculptured. Everybody admires the horse. You read that bit, verse 19. Hast thou given the horse strength? Hast thou closed his neck with thunder? You know, that curving neck? Shalt thou make him afraid of the grasshopper? The glory of his nostrils is terrible. You see the widening nostrils of the horse. He paweth the valley. He rejoiceth in his strength. He goeth out to meet the armed men. He mocketh at fear. He's not frighted. Neither turneth he back from the sword. The quiver rattleth against him. The glittering spear and the shield, then he swallows the ground with fierceness and rage. You see him thundering over in the charge, how helpless you are under the charge of a horse. He swallows the ground with fierceness and rage, neither believeth he that it is the sound of the trumpet? He saith among the trumpets, ha ha, he smelleth the battle afar off, the thunder of the captains and the shouting. Isn't that some statement? Isn't that one of the greatest pieces of poetry written, I reckon? Classic remark, presentation of hyperbole, you know, where things are said in exaggerated form, make you struck home by this magnificent animal. Can you make that? Can you provide the hawk with a clear sighted eye, which can see right up as it goes moving down the ground, way up there? That the hawk fly by your wisdom, stretch its wings towards the south, that the eagle mount up at thy command, that the hawk is soaring there to dive, and catch its prey with its sharp eyes, this is a magnificent eagle floating up and making its nest on the rocks. Can you do that? Verse 27, that make the eagle mount up, make a nest on high. That alone is enough for Job. And God stops short there. And he answers Job, said again, shall he that contendeth with the Almighty instruct him? You contend with me, can you instruct me? Can you that's what you are. Then he goes down bit by bit, these times have come to you, which puts in the prophet of Jesus, look at the sea. Could you bind the sea so as you have set the shores and limitations? There's verses 8 onwards. So it doesn't overflow and cut anything, so it keeps it safe. Could you do that? And then he moves on to verse 12. He says, could you produce the wonderful dawn for the ghost too? Beautiful phrase, the very things of an eye, says in the court of Jesus. But the earlier, the questions of the dawn. Could you bring that to me? And then the light dawns, and he uses it, the light shines, and you lose the house, different colors that people do, so you can try to see what they should do. Could you do the other way? Can you open the gate to death? Can you handle death in its meaning? Do you have a meaning? One great question mark and one thing is to rock there, till you find the answer of Jesus Christ. That's in verse 17. Do you know where light comes from? That's a great question of how it is today. What's light? Everything's light. The fire has its speed, how it's operating. The fire has its gravity, everything really, some form of light. Which way is the way of light today? They continue to ask, after, whatever it is now, 5,000 years, they still ask about this. They're still feebly investigating around through the field telescope and through the electronic microscope and so on, trying to find the tiniest particle up to the thing they have at what they call it, where the stars get together. What they all mean. They move on again, so, have you entered the treasures of the snow? And you get these different poetic terms. Have you seen the treasures of the hay? Can you produce as beautiful as the snow, as sparkling as the sun? That's in verse 22. It's the very rain that brings questions by that doubt and panic. You get? Can you cause it to rain, you said in verse 26? And cause the rain and the wilderness where no man is, and bring up children to desolate ground? 27. I love the phrase, hast thou known a father? You have these perfect phrases, it's a beautiful for shooting you. 28. Hast thou known a father? That's a simple, beautiful way of putting it. Are you the father alone? Ice? And who's wind the ice come? Could you produce that then? And who's wind, is that a phrase? 28. And the hoary frost, the frost, and who's good at it? And we all know the beauty of the frost when you get these. And it goes down in Washington these days and the ice freezes on the trees, every little branch sparkles. Did you hear that? They turned it away from things of earth to things of heaven. Because, can you keep together that little group of stars for the paradies? That can be seen as a group of the heavens. Could you hold those together? Verse 31? is that the first time that the parents of the amateur of the great men back about them, the situation of the star of the assembly, the prayer of the good for the paradies, the sequences, I don't know why that phrase is particularly, the very difficult phrase. Canst thou bind the sequences of the paradies? Or could you just wrap up and say the line together? Around that great constellation of the, like a man in a belt. And even one of its stars alone different girls. A great star is about 1,000 times as big as the sun. This one star. This great band that goes on in Orion. And you see, of course, you hear blowing the tropics. It's a thrill to see the night sky in the tropics. With a cousin called Shannon. A curious light to get in these. And you can see the Orion so often, and see just a few constellations, you know. Because we left the North Star behind, you know, and then going, this is a journey you have in course you get. Night after night, when I fled down the Nile, I went about 5 times down the Nile, on little petal sea men, on the crocodiles and whatnot. And it used to sit out in the mosquito cabin at night. You know, you could see this beautiful tropical sky. Every star seems to have an extra shadow on it. Can you do that? Can you handle the zodiac? The word in the King James is Nazareth. Can't that be called Nazareth? Nazareth is a zodiac. They do talk about it in astrology about the zodiac. In the aquatic age, and they are coming on to it. So all the history has been talking about the zodiac. It seems to have been some silent outline of the gospel message. I'm not going to go over. There may be much about astrology, which we don't think much about. There may not be much in it. Something in the wise ways of the East. There's been called something in the stars guiding the Bethlehem. And I'm not saying there isn't something in the zodiac and the message of the I think they're able, if anyone's done it, to trace out the process of the gospel. See the different sides of the zodiac. See the relationship. Can you bring forth the zodiac? Can you buy that great London constellation called the Bear, the Great Bear? Because I got up close with his son, that's a great bear. So there you put him on his spot. You handle this marvelous array. Can you move him about and lift up one and touch up another? And arrange the zodiac in his courses? Then he moves on to animal life. Get a few touches from animal nature. He starts by the lion. He says, could you try to play with the lion? Verse 39. Could you think, you ever ask the young lion? Could you provide him with the necessary meat? Or, show the world how to get the food for the young ones? So this is the bird, getting the food for the young ones. Lions won't get the food for themselves. Time they are prey. And we all know in the bird life how they spend their ages getting their different food for their young ones. And so the verse 31 could say, can you provide the raising of the food for which his young ones cry to God? This is kind of a similar, wilder types of animal less known to us now. The breeding of the wild goats. Can you undertake how they bring their children, how they bring their new ones into birth? The wild goats? Can you number the months they fulfill? In other words, the months of pregnancy? Can you order that, the regular pregnancy of animals? Or could you have in the wild ass, the wild donkey? It's a very independent gentleman, the donkeys usually are, human as well as animal. Could you handle him, this independent fellow? And he fights in the wilderness, the barren land is barren, he scores the match in the city. The guy that's not the cry of the driver, takes the words of anybody. Lovely you touch it, okay? The range of the mountains is his pasture, especially for the green thing. The wild the ox, the same, called the unicorn here. The animals, of course, are more the desert animals. That's verse 9. The wild donkey, the wild ass is verse 5. Chapter 39. There are little touches. He says, could you produce the dignity of the peacock? I like that, don't you? 13. Could you produce those wonderful colorings? They just do the good things of the peacock. And he kept the very opposite end. Could you produce that funny, careless animal called the ostrich, who goes lazy legs and sands, leaves the sand to warm up and forgets the eggs? And then he says, and it was God who deprived her of wisdom. God made him silly anyhow, that's his fault. I like that touch, that's in verse. Verse 17. God deprived the ostriches. I didn't know ostriches did do that, actually. They didn't turn like a young one, hide the eggs in the turn, lift to be crushed, and lift the sand out to the warm sand as the incubator. And God deprived the wisdom. Why should now the ostrich is lifted up as if on high, scorned the horse and his rider. Have you seen that? The ostrich is there, exactly trying to get nobody. Those things are that beautiful, that medicine sitting under a horse. It's worth reading yet. Or that they feel. It's amazingly poetic. The horse, they all feel a strength for the animal, a clean-cut animal. We've always loved horses. There's great limbs, there's wonderful muscles. It's special, like something sculptured. That everybody admires the horse. We read that bit, verse 19. Hast thou given the horse strength? Hast thou clothed his neck with thunder? Is that a curving neck? Shalt thou make him afraid of the grasshopper? The glory of his nostrils is terrible. You see the widening nostrils of the horse. He paweth the valley, he gusheth in his strength, he goeth unto meet the armed men. He mocketh at fear, he's unfighted, neither turneth he back from the sword. The quiver rattleth against him, the glittering spear and the shield. Then he swalloweth the ground with fierceness and rage. You see him thundering over in the charge. How helpless you are under the charge of a horse. He swalloweth the ground in the fierceness and rage. Neither believeth he that it is the saddle or something. He set among the trappers, ha ha! He swelleth the battle afar off, the thunder of the captains and the shouting. Isn't that some safety? Isn't that one of the greatest piece of poetry written, I reckon? Classic remark, presentation of hyperbole, you know, where things are said in exaggerated form, making it struck home by this magnificent animal. Can you make that? Can you provide the hawk with a clear sighted eye, which can see right up and see the thing down the ground, way up there. Let the hawk fly by your wisdom, stretch its wings towards the south, that the eagle mount up at our command, that the hawk is soaring there to dive, and catch its prey in sharp eyes. This is the magnificent eagle, floating up and making its nest on the rocks. Can you do that? Verse 37, let the eagle mount up, make her nest on high. That alone is enough for Job. And God stops short there. And he answers Job, said again, shall he that continues to be Almighty instruct him? You contend with me, can you instruct me? Teach me how to do this and this and this and this and this. and go about it. They see the limited knowledge of God as if the ignorance of man. For whom I desire, what shall I answer thee? I lay my hand upon my mouth. Chapter 14, verse 3. Once have I spoken, thou wilt not answer, yet twice I will proceed no further. By thy first glimpse of the helplessness, the ignorance of man, not quite yet the helplessness, the ignorance of man, and no nothingness of man. What are you trying to describe how God does things, or how you do nothing? Can you do any of these things? Is that a tremendous presentation to nature? Or is it my nature, a tremendous presentation? Incident after incident, things after things, is it beautiful, marvelous, wonderful, ordered? Incident after that case, you can't touch one of them. God does a lot. He has one more final blow to Job's humanity, not to Job's Holy Spirit center, but to his soul reaction, his humanity, and that's the powerlessness. He just uses two simple examples of the animal power. He's spent all this on wisdom so far, the intricacy of wisdom which can make these things what they are. Now, I said, take the power of the animals, see if you can do that. And he picks out the hippopotamus. That's if it is hard day, then I pick out the elephant. And that's going to beat him off. It does say the elephant in margin, but it speaks about this animal as the shady trees covering them in their shadow, and the willows of the book covers him about. He doesn't care about water, he doesn't do what he likes with water. It's different than what an elephant does. A hippopotamus does, doesn't matter which. Anyhow, it's an enormous animal. Look at his bones, it says. His bones are stronger than pieces of glass. This is verse 15 onwards in chapter 14. Singular as stones wrapped together. His bones like glass. His bones are bars of iron. And these great, pondering, powerful animals, what do you do with them? I took in my life one day, because I went out shooting the hippopotamus, where I knew one was in the river. But I forgot these bars, these bones like iron. I shot him. But the bullet bounced off. it annoyed him. That's my trouble. And that old beggar stayed in the middle of that stream, which is about 200 yards broad, all day, cutting his head up. I couldn't pass him to get back. I had little canoe. I couldn't get past, I didn't dare. And so he might say, I'm unmired if possible. And so I lay on an old trunk, kicking the ants off, the ants like old trunks, kicking the ants off. All day I lay there. And when evening time came, I took a chance off and face. I slipped back to me by and that thing, because I asked before he got me. The reason why I shot a hippopotamus is a meat for the Africans. They love hippopotamus, they put plenty of meat on it too. So I didn't get my prey for the Africans, I'm afraid. I saved them my life and beat them off. So I think they're mighty animals anyhow. They're mild animals. Big grass, it says so here. They're not carnivorous. Verse 15, he's grass like an ox. He's slow moving, not all that slow. He's amphibious. He lives in the water, lives on the land. You find him on both. He knows how far in the land. He is, he says he had the shade of the trees, in the marshland, that's where you find him, all just in the rivers. School dogma, of course. But they're very harmless. You don't bother any hippopotamus, except if the Africans need meat. Then he picks up otherwise the fiercest of animals. If you don't play it, the crocodile. So he makes those examples of the power of the physical makeup of one of these huge animals, and the philosophy If the advisor makes you wise, keep out of his way, and then cock it back. And he plays about with that. He says, this is verse 41, chapter 41. When you put a hook in his nose, or a boy's shirt jaw through with a thorn, it's more than that. I like it, the idea of verse 5. Did you play with him as a bird? Did you have a pet crocodile? Did you bind him to your daughter? They said to have your schnauzer, have a crocodile. It's quite different. He says, you watch him. He says, because it's no man so fierce. That's they are fierce, but it's a... they don't need to stir you up as far as I know. They need to stir you up, they get jobs. The only way they knew how to handle crocodiles is crocodiles don't come by the water, by the running water, by the waterfall. So my wife and I, Pauline, you see, sipping in the hot days in this river under a little waterfall, but the crocodiles out here, they didn't come, so you're safe. They didn't make a play with him like a bird, so we avoided that one. He then stand before him. And so he uses those phrases, verse 14, who can open the doors of his face? Some, his teeth are terrible round about. His tails are as his proud, shut up, so nothing can get between them. They join like one to another, stick together, the terrible sunlight. It goes on almost as if he speaks of the mythical dragon, and saying a dragon, where sparks come out of it. That was just a very hyperbole, a very statement, it speaks of sparks came from him, so I'm like the old mythical dragon idea, because I've never watched such animals as far as we know. And so he goes on to this chapter, presenting the huge strength of the elephant, the hippopotamus, and the fierceness of the ferocity of the crocodile. That ends it. That is Gilmore. This outpouring, I suppose it came in some form of vision. Whether it was spoken verbally to him, I don't know, but it's a marvelous presentation. Nowadays something happened. Job had seen, he hadn't got the return. Now you see, the answer isn't in my knowledge or my strength. To the last see the helplessness of self. In its relationship with independent, that this had come home to now. And so now he speaks again in the last chapter to God. And Job answered the Lord, I know thou canst do anything, and no thought can be withheld, withheld upon me. Here I'm teaching, I will speak. Now verse 5. Now, here's it. Silent in the dawn of vision, the dawn of the Spirit, the full sunlight of the Spirit. I've heard of thee, but I hear you in my ear, now mine eye seeth thee. Stop it. So now he is in seeing vision always. You only see what you wonder. Now I see. Now I'm with you in what you are. Oh, this is it. I'm with this wonderful God. His wonderful wisdom, wonderful power, the details of untold duties and controls and just in nature. I'm wondering at this far, I see him now. He's not some distant creator figure to me. He's the one with whom I come into inner sight. Is the inner union, because this was my idea to be not out of the inner union. Now that it's a transformation game, because you live in the liberty of him or that with which you're united. Now he moves away. To sit in his body of this, the devil in the spirit, please. Now, friends. He says, I've got the elements. Why, God, he's given me this and this and this. Now he's filled up with the glory and the truth. But he and God are together in what is we take our language in this union by which he is just a means by which God is showing what is wisdom and showing what is glory. And God takes him this way to bring him to the final end of the a separated self-object, he saw what could happen to me. I don't want this to happen. I would like this to happen. I want to learn like this. Separated self means it's still the independent self, the core. A separated self will want what it wants, and try to avoid what it wants to avoid. There's trouble if you can't do that. So although there wasn't a separated self in the United States, he didn't know who he really was. So all the book of Job is concerned with Job, who he really was. The come back to one, the Lord gave, the Lord took it away. This is the will of the Lord. You say, the Lord says good, why can't he also take it away? Now he's back there. I'm no longer a separated person. Living a life under my own plans or pleasures or ambitions or gains. I'm a very fit and new person. I'm a form of God, and my place in life is still the manifest of people with the love and beauty and power and presence of God, and the availability of God's love and grace to all men. Now, lift it out into this freedom from self-questioning, self-pity, self-condemnation, freedom. So it said, my mind changed. Verse 6, I abhor myself, I repent. Repentance is a mind. I repent, I drop this business and I did need something, I have something. No. I'm fully yours now, I'm fully your man. No ages. That shows the world what you want to show the world. Now, of course, liberty, joy, fact, and convict, self-pity, alienation disturbs. And the element gave a billion is the self-pity element. Now it's in the self-liberty, the freedom, the joy, the praise element. Now this is moved over to the brothers, the things. Apparently they had a local separation, because in verse 7, after they all said to Job, which meant probably the atmosphere changed, they at least heard something happening in Job, come to God, saying, looking to one of the Lord, and occupied it, and seeing the light of the Lord's servant, and this is a different Job, what happened? Because it said after Job had spoken, then he spoke to the friends. Now the likelihood that the friends weren't so far off, because they'd just been having this controversy, and probably they separated, like you separated, you know, a little trouble between you. And the voice came to the friends. Well, the friends heard God's voice too. So it said the Lord spoke to the friends, to Eliphaz and the others. That could have been again an inner conviction. Well, yes, we see, we knock up that three spirit of Job. We've been wrong somewhere. We've had the wrong thing here. We've been saying things we shouldn't say. So whether it came from direct word in the middle of the friend, or whether it came through, as I said, change up the same, the answer. Anyhow, its result was that they must have what Job had. You have not spoken to me the thing is right, verse 7, as my servant Job had. Well, Job hadn't looked at the right thing, but God. So in other words, Job got it now. You better get what Job's got. You haven't got what Job's got. So you see, come on now, come on. And let's go back to Job now. So he said to him, verse 7, They have to go. And make sure that they didn't obey the recognition of God's grace and, by sacrifice and so on, that you could meet God through sacrifice if they didn't obey. But they have to go. Now Job approached because I accept Job. Job was far too busy to pray for them to have something. He was far more occupied getting to them what he got, which was acceptance. So that's the prayer you get from Job. I accept Job. So here, I accept Job. By Job, he says it. He says, for him that I accept, in the verse 8, and the Lord accepted Job. Verse 9. Accepted his freedom. It says, no one was so afraid of God, I understand that. That was his prayer. His prayer for the burden is the prayer of faith. He said, come on now, let's do together, you see. You got free from wrong attitudes yourself. You're not busy looking at the wrong attitudes of the other person. You're busy telling them they're free. And they're busy receiving their own too. Come on, let's have the freedom. The freedom, because anyhow it's based on sacrifice, so you don't got that. So his prayer, so he prayed his brothers, the prayer of love, fellowship, and acceptance, and transition, based on acceptance. And there it says in verse 10, the Lord turned the captivity of Job when he prayed to his friends. Job was never captive to any husband. Job was captive to his body, captive to his spirit. The captivity of Job is a captivity. The captivity is wrong attitude. Questioning and doubting sense of diary and law, that is his captivity. And the Lord turned the captivity, so then when you transmit it, when you externalize it, because of you, and the same principle is, long after, Paul said, if you confess your mouth to the Lord, you have salvation. If you believe in your heart, you have justification. Justification is God saying, in my sight you're right. You do have your heart. You can say, well, God, I trusted Jesus, and God's righteousness is God's country righteous. Well, God's country righteous. That's in my heart. Confession is their salvation. Because confession justifies something. That's it, justifies contact you will. So you don't get the liberation of salvation, you need to confess Christ and believe immediately. Even if these are the fact, I think many in our churches like that, who have had the gospel, and inwardly, and maybe they like to take the Holy Communion and whatnot, they have a joy, a liberty with it. And in a sense, well, this is the way God provided, and so now I'm accepted. And therefore, they believe in their heart of the righteousness, and in God's heart they accept it. But they haven't got that which liberates from the brothers. When they move into confession, which doesn't mean confession, which means they confess the mouth of the Lord Jesus to other people, because that's a high thing. Because the objective has a weak attraction, because indeed they are objectified. So as he affirmed his freedom to the brothers and with the brothers, and they together got the freedom, his captivity was gone. Oh, send me this freedom. So that it is captivity, because that's where the captivity is. Now the household has changed. The lonely man becomes a happy family man. Because the state of the household has changed. Instead of, I reckon that he's getting healed too. I reckon when the spirit gets healed, the body gets something too. Because it says that all the family began together. His brothers and sisters came out for some distances and ate bread with him. There's no difficulty to eat bread with a man full of boils. Luckily, he had less boils than that, I think. I think probably he was asked to eat his body. Because there was company, fellowship, freedom, fun, joy. This was something new. So what drew the brethren? Wasn't it poor so pretty and dear when they asked him? It was Job's strength of actually sensation. and sitting on this treasure map, the treasure of God and His love and His beauty and His power and His goodness. And this is what he and Jonah proposed the Lord to what he did, and led this to us what he did, and moved their hearts to comfort him, to other words, show their love with him. Perhaps Jonah's comforting them more than he did, but there's this fellow, this flow. Here, the contaminant coming to be again. It has ultimate effect on his family life. Doesn't always, I suppose, have that way, but he had a renewal, a vast increase in his prosperity. And that he got the camels and horses and the large family. He had 7 sons more, didn't he? And 4 daughters, and 3 daughters. So his wife, I believe he only had one. She already had at least 6 grandsons. She didn't do that. She tried again, had 7 more. God bless her. And 3 daughters. and they were beautiful girls. Of course, all girls are beautiful, aren't they? No women were found so fair as in 6 country North Morgan. As in the house of the Job. and they were blessed. And Job lived 140 years. Died old and full of days. So that's the lesson of Job, that by all means, he takes us all that way. This is the permanent way. By all means, he uses evil, and actually, we see here sometimes that they're parked off and think they have to do it. But as the impact of evil, only by that peace can it be unified outlook, which can force us to say it isn't only the good from God, it's all from God. The unified outlook becomes a unified permanent condition. This is this meaning. When you settle into it, through prayer and shadow, and birth, and you're settled into a unified condition. Now this is the permanent condition. Now this is God. You know, that's when you're running around yourself. You've got the power. You've got yourself now. It's God's agent. Produces comfort and joy and blessing and fulfillment. And it's a sheer attention. Self, because we're here in a tempted world, and we don't live with the world, we're in a situation, have those two temptations. We don't live fussing about temptation. We're the free people. In God's freedom, in God's joy. In the realization that it is really, this perfect joy, I'm in the genius, he's the real person, and now he's transfigured to a few brothers. I'm occupied by other people getting what I've got. This is the life. Well, I haven't, there's another thing you have to say on Job. I thought it would be a bit shorter. Yes, sir.
He wants to explain again about the confession with your mouth and
living
in your heart.
That's I think it's quite important. Point of all faith. So it's sort of effort that concerns me is something to protect it when I'm speaking it out or acting about it. He's speaking about what Moses originally spoke about, and I said yesterday in Deuteronomy, the word is in our mouth and our heart. The word of faith, if we keep the word, it means Christ is there. The word of faith can only be, only Christ is the word of faith. It's there already, because Christ is there already. And you're not specific to say that. You don't pull him down from above, or pull him up from beneath. This is, I look at it now, it's the 10th chapter. Romans 10 and 9. But Moses described the righteousness and so on, and that's very righteous. Verse 6, the righteousness of the faith speaketh on this side, actually, is Moses' faith.